Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, the number of officer-involved shootings at Fresno PD has dropped dramatically in the last 6 months. The number of complaints about excessive use of force have also dropped. FM 89's Jeffrey Hess will bring us a report that digs into the numbers, seeking some explanation, and we'll find out why one group still isn't happy, despite the drop. We'll also learn why some biologists fear the Delta smelt may be on the verge of extinction, what it means for the Delta ecosystem and for Valley farmers. And we'll take a look at the upcoming events set to recognize the centennial of the Armenian Genocide, including the unveiling of a new memorial in Fresno. But first, we turn our attention to the intersecting worlds of agriculture and labor. Every summer and fall, Prima brand peaches and grapes from Fresno-based Gurawan Farming can be found in supermarkets across the country. But the workers who pick the fruit are currently at the center of one of California's biggest labor conflicts. FM 89's Diana Aguilera reports that the stakes are high for both the company and the UFW.
Most elections usually follow a somewhat predictable pattern. People vote on candidates or an issue, someone collects the ballots, someone else counts the votes, and then you get the results. But when it comes to California's Agricultural Labor Relations Board, it's a bit more complicated. A year and a half after workers at Fresno-based Gurawan Farming held an election to determine the future of their relationship with the United Farm Workers Union, the votes remain uncounted, locked away at a nondescript office in Visalia.
Where are those ballots?
They're in a safe here in this office.
And what do you do with them?
Nothing. We're just keeping them here until the board says it's time to open them and count them, or time to destroy them, or whatever the board decides to do.
That's Silas Shaver, the regional director for the ALRB.
I'm not going to tell you any more details than that.
No, I am. Okay.
Shaver helps run the state agency that is investigating claims that the process before the vote wasn't fair. It's just the latest chapter in California's largest ag labor battle of the last decade. It pits the UFW, founded by Cesar Chavez, against Gurawan, the nation's largest peach grower. In the middle are as many as 5,000 workers who both sides claim are being denied their rights, and the ALRB, which is responsible for holding elections and enforcing the rights of workers. The fight has attracted national attention from groups on both the left and the right. The stakes are high. A win for the UFW could give the union a major membership boost after years of struggles and cause ripples throughout the state's multi-billion dollar ag industry. A win for the company would be a major setback in the effort to re-energize organized labor in California fields. Philip Martin is a farm labor expert at UC Davis.
It's clear that there's much less union activity today than there was 40 years ago in California agriculture. If the UFW were to win, clearly this would be by far their biggest contract.
The roots of the conflict go back 25 years. After an election in 1990, the UFW won the right to represent company employees. Gurawan and the UFW met once but couldn't agree on a contract, and talks ended. Dan Gurawan, who runs a family business, claims the union disappeared.
During that entire time, we never had any contact from them. Not a phone call, not a fax, not an email, not a letter, nothing. They completely abandoned our employees.
Then in 2012, the union returned to the bargaining table. That sparked a movement among some anti-union Gurawan employees like Sylvia Lopez to decertify the UFW.
We don't need the union. They just want our money, and we know that for clear.
Lopez says she's been working at Gurawan for 15 years. She claims the majority of Gurawan employees don't want the union to represent them or to take 3% of their paychecks in dues. She also says many current employees weren't around for the 1990 vote.
The ALRB office that's supposed to protect our rights and let us to have a free choice to choose if we want to be represent or we don't for the union, and now they're the one who's forcing us to have a contract with a union.
In November 2013, Garawan employees got to vote on the union in a decertification election. But today, a year and a half later, the ballots still haven't been counted over charges that Garawan illegally promoted the election and tried to turn employees against the union. The company denies the accusations, which were the subject of a six-month-long hearing. An administrative judge will soon decide whether the ballots from the decertification election should be counted. Dan Garawan says there's only one fair option.
We want our employees to be able to choose for themselves whether to be part of the union. They embarked on this decertification drive. So clearly, the only fair and equitable way to decide this entire thing is to count the ballots.
But not all farm workers agree with the anti-union sentiment. Maria Perez, who voted during the decertification election back in 2013, says she voted for the union.
I like it because with the union, I mean, you have rights. It's not that I don't like the company. It's about the rights. It's about the benefits, and it's about the worker.
Perez says she worked at Garawan Farming, picking peaches for nearly 10 seasons. But in 2013, she started supporting the union and never got a call back to work there again.
So I'm still waiting for my today to give me my job back, but they're not, because they know already that I'm supporting the union, so they don't want me there.
The election is critical because if the UFW prevails, a little-known state law allows a mediator to impose a contract on both sides. The UFW's National Vice President Armando Elenes says the contract would give farm workers more protections and job security.
When we were talking to these employees again in 2012, they weren't really complaining about their wages. They were complaining about working conditions. They were complaining about being terminated, about being disciplined.
Elenes says the union never disappeared and wants the company to follow along.
What's really about is for these workers to try to improve their conditions and trying to get their union contract. And a company that's using its vast amount of resources and not allowing these employees to have that.
He says they have no other option than to have the mediator impose the contract, since even recent talks with the company failed.
After numerous sessions of negotiations, we had workers there, of course. The workers and us saw right away that it wasn't going to go anywhere. And so they said, look, we got to invoke the mediation law.
But Garawan is challenging the mandatory mediation law itself in court, saying it's unconstitutional because it doesn't give workers the right to vote on the contract. His lawsuit and the controversy over the election have ignited a fierce debate over the future of ag labor relations and the role of the ALRB. Critics like Sylvia Lopez claim the agency is favoring the union and its employees have close ties with the UFW. In February, at a rally outside the state capitol, Lopez engaged in a shouting match with UFW spokesman Mark Grossman.
Why you don't count the votes so you can know who wants the union, how many who doesn't want the union?
There's a judge that's been hearing testimony since September on those.
One of your friends?
No.
Oh, for sure. He's a judge from the ALRB.
That's an independent state agency. It has nothing to do with the UFW.
Oh, are you sure?
The ALRB's Silas Chauver denies the claims that the agency is acting unfairly.
Our job is to protect the process, to carry out a careful investigation.
But he says when it comes to the case, it's complicated.
The judge and the board really has to be neutral, right? They have to look at everything from both sides and analyze all the evidence and make a decision. For us, under the general counsel, because we're a prosecutor, we look at the evidence impartially when we're investigating a case. And then we have to make an assessment. Once we make an assessment that there's been a violation, then we're no longer so neutral, right? Because we're prosecuting somebody.
And labor historian Nelson Lichtenstein with UC Santa Barbara says the ALRB exists to help farm workers organize.
The point of the ALRB is to facilitate trade unionism in agriculture. Now, they have rules and you can't violate the rules, but I mean, that is the point of it. I mean, it was established for that purpose.
The fight between Garawan and the UFW has attracted national attention. Big farm organizations, including the Western Growers Association, are supporting Garawan's efforts. Other groups, such as the Center for Worker Freedom, have helped organize anti-union demonstrations. They're associated with a conservative advocacy group, Americans for Tax Reform. The UFW side has also found a sympathetic audience. City leaders in Berkeley, Los Angeles, and San Francisco have all passed resolutions demanding Garawan recognize a union contract. Back in Visalia, Silas Shaver says the ALRB is just trying to do their job in an unusual case that's at the center of attention in California's agriculture industry.
Has there ever been a case this big? I don't know. I think we just had the longest hearing that we've ever had. But this is certainly big, and I think it's unique as far as how complex it is.
An administrative judge is expected to rule by May whether the ballots from the decertification election should be counted. Meanwhile, the hearings have started in Garawan's case challenging the state mandatory mediation law, and it's currently in the 5th District Court of Appeal. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Yana Galera.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Now we turn to the world of law enforcement. At the Fresno Police Department, the number of officer-involved shootings and complaints are both down dramatically. In fact, before yesterday's accidental shooting of a police cadet by another trainee who was cleaning a gun at a department training facility, it had been roughly 6 months since the department had recorded an officer-involved shooting. As Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess reports, both police and community activists say a shift in the national mood about law enforcement is driving the change, but some question whether it will last.
Fresno police used to average one officer-involved shooting every month and log dozens of complaints of excessive force and racial profiling, among other concerns. But now, complaints and officer-involved shootings are down. The reason for the decline is twofold, according to Police Chief Jerry Dyer. First, Dyer says the decline is a result of new training, focusing officers on de-escalating tense situations.
That includes providing mental health awareness training to our officers that is extensive. That means to make sure that their training that they are being provided causes them to slow down the call and to make sure we have sufficient number of officers on scene and resources.
But Dyer also points out that cops feel like they're under siege by national events that have cast police in a negative light. He says they realize that some people no longer give them the benefit of the doubt.
Also is as a result of the national climate. Officers are well aware of the fact that across this country there's increased criticism and scrutiny of officers. And so I do believe, not only in Fresno, but in many agencies across the country, there's a reluctance on the part of officers to get engaged in certain types of incidents for fear that they're going to have to use force or deadly force.
Officer-involved shootings and complaints began declining last year, from around 500 complaints a year in 2012 to 400 in 2014. And the department's on pace to record less than 350 complaints this year. Some community leaders are not convinced the department has had a true change of heart.
People believe that if you engage police in our city, you can't have a conversation with them. People still believe that if you do that, then you're going to get shot. That's reality. In the streets
That's
of Fresno.
Booker Lewis, a pastor at Rising Star Missionary Baptist Church and a member of the organizing group Faith and Community. Lewis doesn't dispute the numbers, but he suspects the recent change is more of a public relations push from the top rather than a truly fundamental shift.
Dyer and other people in the department, I think that's them saying that this cannot, Michael Brown, Eric Garner, all the stuff that's been happening around the country, the fact that we had the protests at City College and went to Ferguson, this cannot happen here.
Lewis says any improvement in relations is superficial and unlikely to heal suspicions that Fresno police don't truly know how to constructively interact with the public. Another pastor, Chris Breedlove of Community United Church of Christ, says if it was this easy to decrease shootings and complaints, what took so long?
If it was just a matter of Dyer saying, all right, fellas, let's settle down and let's play it cool, calm, and collective, why wasn't that the posture toward the community before 6 months ago? It should have been that way all along.
The group has a list of demands they say the department should pursue to transform itself, from a civilian oversight board to implicit bias training, and notably, a stronger, more independent police auditor. The auditor is dependent on information provided by Fresno Police Internal Affairs and cannot pursue witnesses or conduct his own investigation. Over the last 2.5 years, quarterly reports have nearly always confirmed the findings of the Internal Affairs Review. Police Auditor Rick Rasmussen says it's not his job to find fault with police and rejects assertions that he's too closely tied to the department or city hall.
Reasonable people look at the same facts, they should arrive at a very similar type of conclusion. So the problem isn't that the office isn't set up particularly to arrive at disagreements. The office is set up to ensure that the police department is doing the right thing with the cases that they're examining.
When it comes to the decline in officer-involved shootings and complaints, Rasmussen offers another explanation beyond national events, the creation of his office.
Complaints have decreased, complaints about uses of force have decreased, and officer-involved shootings have drastically decreased, and the only thing that has changed in the last 2.5 years is the office.
The police department is working to form a youth advisory council in an effort to make sure that Fresno is not the next Ferguson. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
This is Valley Edition. This past weekend, a group of computer coders courted a group of farmers in Fresno County to create phone apps for their farms. It's part of an effort that some hope will help transform agriculture. Valley Public Radio's Ezra David Romero reports.
If you've been on the popular dating application Tinder, then you've done this before. Swipe right for a potential date or swipe left to reject someone. But here at the first App for Ag hackathon at West Hills Community College in Coalinga, Tinder meets the world of invasive pests with a new app.
We're opening up Swarm, and the screen asks, have you seen Beet Leafhopper? I'll press no, I haven't seen that today. So have you seen the navel orange worm? Yes, that's a problem in almond trees.
That's Kyle Jorgensen, a developer from Santa Barbara. He and the rest of his team met Eduardo Garcia, a crop advisor from Ventura, at the event and took on the challenge to create Swarm, a phone application that alerts farmers what pests, like the citrus psyllid, could be in their fields. Eduardo Garcia.
When you're out there on a farm on your own, you don't always know what's going on around you. So it's what we're trying to do is find out what else is going around in our environment.
The App for Ag Hackathon is the first of many to be thrown by the United States Department of Agriculture with a goal of connecting farmers and techies to create efficient growing. Robert C. with the USDA Rural Development of California came up with the idea for the agricultural hackathon.
The White House had issued sort of an order that all the federal departments should stage a hackathon. And I took advantage of the opportunity, and then we went forward with this ag hackathon.
The Tinder-like app Swarm was just one of six created at the hackathon. The first night, farmers wore green stickers, and coders had to woo those farmers into choosing them to create an app for that grower's particular issue. Hanford crop advisor Justin Dutra has a problem. He wants to better manage nitrogen he's applied to his almond orchards. Nitrogen is just one component of increasing crop yields, but in large amounts, the element can contaminate the aquifer.
The method I used to use was a lot of written notes per field, how much we've applied. It's just not a quick reference when you're in the middle of a field and you're wondering how much nitrogen you have on it. Well, you basically have to go to your truck, get your binder, and flip through all the pages.
Sandeep Giddy and his developing team from San Francisco ended up winning over Dutra at the event.
We literally turned to our right, and there he was with the green sticker. Hey, you're a guy with a green sticker. It was love at first sight. And so an hour had gone by, and we were still talking. So which, you know, in a dating scenario, that would be a good thing. Which in this scenario was also good.
Together, Dutra and the coding team created the app NutriSource in 24 hours. It takes existing data and new soil information input by the farmer into the app and then spits out a timeline of when and how much nitrogen the trees need. Dutra says the hackathon opened his eyes to what coding can do for agriculture.
That's what makes me feel really cool is like, you know, I helped them come up with this. I can use this today in what I do, and I think most people that I know would too.
But NutriSource didn't win it all. The team came in third place, only to be beaten by the tomato irrigation app, Tomato to a T, and the Tinder-like app, Swarm. Eduardo Garcia, the crop advisor from Ventura, says the app Swarm, created specifically for him at the hackathon, has changed his perspective on farming.
I will no longer need to wonder if these problems are local just to fields that I consult or inspect myself. I'll be able to validate these findings by the results that my neighbors are posting as well.
Garcia is just one example of how the USDA would like to bridge the gap between Silicon Valley and the San Joaquin Valley. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero.
Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment on Valley Edition and learn more about the events in Fresno this week to mark the 100th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide. There's a new memorial coming to Fresno State. We'll find out more about the local history connected with this tragic event and the international politics that plagues the issue to this day. That's coming up on Valley Edition.
Valley Public Radio's wine tasting is Sunday, May 3rd. FM 89's signature fundraising event is made possible with help from our corporate sponsors. Here's Vernon Crowder of Rabobank.
It's our pleasure at Rabobank to support Valley Public Radio. Rabobank is proud to be the transportation sponsor for our South Valley guests, providing round-trip bus service from Bakersfield and Visalia. It's easy to get tickets, simply at kvpr.org.
Morning Edition is awake around the clock to bring you the latest news.
It's 2:10 in the morning, so still 5 hours left.
The hosts are usually here around 3:30.
You have Ophibia at 4,
uh-huh.
And it's about the Boko Haram ISIS news over the weekend.
Crunch time is 4 a.m.
Until 5 when the show starts.
Hit it. Open.
Good morning, I'm David Green. With
Morning Edition, up all night to bring you all you need to know. Listen tomorrow.
Listen weekdays, 3 a.m. to 9 on Valley Public Radio.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. 100 years ago this week, authorities of the Ottoman Empire rounded up hundreds of Armenian intellectuals and political leaders in Constantinople and executed them. 1.5 million would eventually die in what we know today as the Armenian Genocide. Some who were fortunate enough to survive fled to places like Fresno, which will observe the centennial with events throughout the week. In a few minutes, we'll learn more about the unveiling of a new memorial to the victims at Fresno State. But first, here to bring us more insight into the story and that of the people of the Armenian diaspora is Barlow Dermogradichian, coordinator of the Armenian Studies Program at Fresno State. Barlow, welcome.
Thank you, Joe.
Barlow, what exactly happened on April 24th, 1915?
That was the day that the Ottoman Turkish government arrested more than 250 Armenian intellectuals, leaders, members of parliament, and basically arrested them without any reason and then sent them out within a few months to their death. So this really marks the symbol for the commemoration of the Armenian Genocide.
Now, there was a large Armenian population in Turkey at the time, or are we talking – this was the Ottoman Empire at that point. Where did they come from?
Well, Armenians had historically lived in an area called Armenia, but in the 16th century, about 50% of Armenia fell to the Ottoman Turks. So prior to World War I and before the beginning of the genocide, there were approximately 2.2 million Armenians living in the Ottoman Empire, with a substantial number living in the Ottoman capital of Constantinople. And that's where the arrest took place as really a symbolic beginning, because then already the genocide was taking place had already begun in other areas of the Ottoman Empire.
So why did this happen? What was the subtext in the history of that time that led to this terrific event?
There's been much research on the origins and the causes of the Armenian Genocide. So there's really not a simple answer, but I can try to give you several factors which I believe contributed to the Armenian Genocide. First and foremost, the leaders of the Ottoman Empire at that time were the Committee of Union and Progress. And they had an ideology which was called Pan-Turkism, which really called for a Turkey for the Turks only. So any other groups living within the Ottoman Empire, whether they be Christians, Armenians, Christian Armenians, or other people, either had to convert to Islam and to become more Turkified, or they should be leave the empire. And so I think the war offered an opportunity for that plan to eliminate the Armenians to take place. So one is this very racist sort of pan-Turkish ideology. Another dimension is economic, because all of the wealth of the Armenians, all of their property, all of their belongings, all of their businesses were simply expropriated when the Armenians were sent to their deaths.
And this was an especially brutal event as well.
Well, there were many dimensions to the genocide, but the primary means of eliminating the Armenian population through was forced deportation. So usually women and young children were forcibly deported from their homes and forced to march on very, very long treks, often for months, until they simply drop from lack of food and lack of water, exposure to the elements, disease. So it's a very, very brutal way of dying.
What did the world say
at the time? Was this widely acknowledged and recognized when it was happening?
Well, the word genocide does not exist in 1915, so that word begins in 1948. But pretty much the entire world recognized that there were atrocities and massacres taking place in the Ottoman Empire. And we can take the record of the United States and the United States Ambassador Henry Morgenthau, who was reporting on what was happening as it was happening. You could take a look at all of the U.S. newspapers, New York Times, reporting back on what was happening in Turkey. So it was no secret. It's just that nothing was done to stop it.
How long did it last?
Well, the first phase of the genocide really was the first year from 1915 to 1916. But actually, events against Armenians continued until 1923. So we say that the scope of the genocide is 1915 to 1923.
We talk about the Armenian diaspora now in present day as Armenians are throughout the world, especially here in the San Joaquin Valley. Was it the genocide that specifically led to Armenians settling here in the valley? And tell me a little more about how the population spread out.
Well, already in the 19th century, there were Armenians coming to the United States for a variety of reasons, some to get an education. Some already had a sort of a foreknowledge that things were getting worse in Turkey. And especially in the 19th century, in the 1890s, when the Armenian massacres of 1895-96 had taken place, many Armenians had already fled from Turkey before the genocide. So the beginnings of the Armenian community here in Fresno are in the 1880s. And so that population just continued to grow, and then especially after the genocide, many more Armenians came and established themselves here in the valley.
And maybe this your family's story. And does your family have its own genocide remembrances in that regard?
Well, both sides of my family, both my father's side and my mother's side, had experiences through the genocide. So on my father's side, they were natives of the area called Van. Van was one of the few areas within the Ottoman Empire that had put up resistance to the genocide. So many of the Armenians were able to, at one point, escape across into the Russian Empire, get protected. And from that there, they actually traveled, my grandparents traveled across Russia to Japan and then to San Francisco, coming to California in that way, which is quite a few less than the other way, which is to go across the ocean, the Atlantic Ocean, and get to New York.
Was that a typical route?
It wasn't a typical route, but it was a route that some Armenians took. However, my grandmother on my mother's side, she was actually a survivor of the deportation marches. So she actually went through those marches along with her own mother and ended up in Aleppo and then finally in Beirut. And then my grandfather, who had already been in America before the genocide, was looking for a wife. And he just asked for somebody that was from the same village. And they sent some photographs and he chose her to come to America.
Now, so much of the story of the genocide exists in the present day, specifically in the denial, the persistent denials by the Turkish government, including current Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Mark Arax had a great piece in The Bee this weekend where he said the denial of the genocide is in itself another genocide. How much does the lack of acknowledgement by the world, by Turkey specifically, shape the Armenian community today?
Without recognizing the Armenian genocide, it's really saying that the Armenian genocide didn't happen and it's a way of rewriting history. And if the Armenians would not fight back against that, then eventually Turkish historians and the Turkish government view of things would predominate. So it has shaped the Armenian experience, the denial of Armenian genocide. And I think it is actually a dimension of genocide, because genocide is the elimination of a population. And so by also denying it, what you're doing is compounding it, because now you're just eliminating even the memories of those people that went through it.
What's the situation like in Turkey today for Armenians who are living there now?
There's a population of about 40 to 50,000 Armenians that remained after the Armenian genocide. And today there are actually a few thousand Armenians from the Republic of Armenia who are working there. But their lives are circumscribed by being Armenian. So they're still being, I think, treated not equally with other Turkish citizens. And I think that's also a consequence of the Armenian genocide.
How significant do you think the recent announcement by Pope Francis was that called on the international community to recognize the events of 1915 and the years after as a genocide? How significant do you think that will prove to be? Turkish Prime Minister since recalled their ambassador to the Vatican. Is this something that we might look back on years from now as something that was an important event?
The 100th anniversary is turning out to be a critical year in this whole question of the Armenian genocide and the denial and affirmation of the genocide. And so for Pope Paul to for Pope Francis to put into effect this statement, to make a statement about the Armenian genocide, I think is very critical because it can be the tipping point for other countries to take their lead. He is the moral leader and the leader of the largest denomination of Christians in the world. His statements are heard, and it did make the news because of his position, a very, very brave position. But the Pope has nothing to really fear, I think. He's got to speak the truth. And so when he speaks like that, I think it's a good sign, and it potentially will lead to many other good events.
The U.S. government has something of a checkered history in terms of acknowledging officially this event. President Obama campaigned on the pledge that he would officially recognize the genocide. The House has a bill that has been circulating just about every year, and some years it passes and some years it doesn't. The administration, though, has avoided using the word genocide rather creatively. Mm-hmm. What do you think of the U.S. record on standing up on this issue?
Actually, early after the genocide, the American record was very clear, standing for affirmation of the genocide, because many of the American diplomats had been eyewitnesses to what was taking place. But over time, as Turkey became a closer ally to the United States, both as a ally in NATO and then economic and military reasons, it seems that the American government, but in particular the executive branch, presidents, have been reticent to use the word genocide and to affirm the genocide. Although many of them promised as candidates to do so, including President Obama and President Bush. So I don't hold much hope that it's going to change this year. And as you mentioned, many presidents use euphemisms. They don't like to use specifically the word genocide, but will use words like massacre or other words. But it is a genocide. And I think America, as one of the leading countries in the world and as a human rights advocate, they have to talk about it, because otherwise it will happen other places, and it's something that needs to be changed.
If in the future Turkey and Turkish leaders had a change of heart and actually did recognize what happened, what do you think the reaction would be? What would that change?
Well, I think it would change a lot, because acknowledging then would open up doors of reconciliation. So there would be cultural avenues, other kinds of avenues, where Armenians then would feel much better about the situation, would want to visit Turkey, want to visit their historic lands. And I think it would just open up many doors. It's not the end, I don't think, but it is a very important beginning.
Do you think you'll see the day that happens in Turkey?
Yeah, I think it's changing. It's changing within society within Turkey. There are leaders, intellectual leaders, political leaders. I don't think that it will never happen, and I think I will see it, or at least it will be happening in the next 5 to 10 years.
Talking about the history of the Armenian Genocide today with Fresno State Armenian Studies Professor Barlow Dermogradichian. Barlow, thank you so much.
Thank you, Joe.
And part of the ceremonies commemorating the 100th anniversary of the genocide involve an event taking place on April 23rd, the unveiling of the Fresno State Armenian Genocide Monument at the Maple Mall. Joining us now in the studio, we have Berj Apkarian. He is the chair of the Monument Committee and the honorary consul for the Republic of Armenia based in Fresno. Berj, welcome.
Good morning, Joe.
Tell me about the monument that you'll be unveiling later this week.
The monument itself has three main purposes. One is to commemorate and honor our martyrs. Second, become a point of education. As you may know, there are over 23,000 students pass through the campus, so this monument will become a point of education, understanding the Armenian history and what transpired. The third, inspiring the younger generation to not only understand what genocide is, but also learn about the Armenian history. And the genocide, it's unacceptable, not only for Armenians, but for the entire man's inhumanity to man is unacceptable. And this monument doesn't only focus on the Armenian genocide itself. It focuses on it, but it expands furthermore, recognizing all other genocides and saying, we do not accept that as a part of human sad chapter of the history, that we continue to not stand up for it and take a firm position.
For several years, for several decades, students at Fresno State have gathered to do a temporary memorial every year in the campus free speech area. Now this permanent memorial is being built. Is there a significance behind the design itself?
Yes. The monument itself consists of 9 pillars. those pillars represent historic regions. It starts from 19 feet high and descending downward to 15 feet high, 1915, the year of the genocide. On the top, there is a halo that is not connected totally. There is a break on that halo, and that, again, has a significance in terms of the jolt, the break during 1915, where the sad chapter occurred in the Armenian history. On the bottom portion of the monument, there is a history timeline, starts from beginning of Armenia and all the way from the genocide to creation of the First Republic, all the way to the Second Republic. So it's a center of education. It's not a memorial. It's a monument to honor, but yet to educate and inspire. It is a everything that you see in that monument, it has a symbolic reason and purpose for it. And I want to mention this. We are very fortunate not only to bring soil from historic Armenia and Armenia and mixed it with local soil and was blessed during the groundbreaking. And that soil now is placed underneath of the monument. And also in addition, we brought the brownish-pinkish stone from Armenia, and it's being placed on the bottom portion of the monument. Again, connecting motherland with the central San Joaquin Valley and connecting the historical perspective. So it is a sign of pride, sign of inspiration, and we look forward for the unveiling on Thursday night.
Now, there are dozens of events that are taking place this month and really throughout the whole year, recognizing this somber centennial. But there's another one coming up in downtown that is significant in the fact of the traditional Armenian neighborhood in downtown and near the Holy Trinity Armenian Apostolic Church. A street is being renamed. Tell us about that.
Yes, thank you very much. And my personal gratitude to Mayor Ashley and her staff for their leadership and for their support. We approached them and presented the idea as far as taking the old Armenia town region just south of Ventura, the street of Santa Clara, from O Street all the way to Van Ness, and to rename it on this important occasion as Armenia Street. We are very excited that that will take place. Thursday afternoon at 3:30, the mayor, consul general of Republic of Armenia from Southern California, His Excellency Mr. Sergei Sarkisov, his staff, the consul, Mr. Minassian, and others, all dignitaries, foreign dignitaries as well, Mexican consul and Italian vice consul, all will be there alongside with the Armenian leaders and the religious leaders to unveil the street name, and I am very excited to witness that moment in time as well.
Again, we've been talking with Berge Apkarian. He is the chair of the Monument Committee for the Fresno Armenian Genocide Monument at Fresno State. The unveiling of that monument is at 7:30 on Thursday at the Maple Mall at Fresno State, and also then the renaming of Santa Clara Street in downtown Fresno taking place earlier that afternoon at 3:30. Berge Apkarian, honorary consul for the Republic of Armenia, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment on Valley Edition and learn more about the fate of the Delta smelt, why some biologists fear the smelt may already be on the brink of extinction. That's coming up next. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. California's drought is turning lawns brown and causing some farmers to rip out decades-old orchards. But the ecological damage is just as dramatic, if not more so. The already stressed Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta ecosystem is ground zero for this situation, which is home to the endangered Delta smelt. Recently, biologists surveying the smelt have made a startling discovery. Just a handful of fish where there should be hundreds. That's led some experts, including our next guest, UC Davis biologist Peter Moyle, to say that we may be witnessing the eventual extinction of this species. Peter Moyle joins us on the phone now. Peter, welcome.
Thank you.
How startling was the news from the recent trawling in the Delta where so few fish were found?
Well, I've been tracking these fish for years, and including in my own surveys, and we've been seeing this long-term decline, but I was quite startled when the spring Kodiak trawl survey, which is run by the Department of Fish and Wildlife, the results came out from that, especially when the March and April results came out showing that they caught only 6 fish in March and only 1 in April. That's this year. And the reason this is upsetting is that this is a trawl survey designed specifically to catch Delta smelt in their reaches where they're spawning.
So exactly what is going on? Obviously, we have the drought. We have the other stressors on the Delta. But why this collapse right now?
Well, it's part of a long-term decline. And the reasons are, unfortunately, complicated. There's no real smoking gun. There's an array of factors that are working together simultaneously to cause this long-term decline in the smelt. But the recent very low numbers, I'm convinced, are the result of conditions being made that much worse by the drought. Less fresh water to dilute pollutants, for example, more favorable conditions for non-native predators and competitors. All the various things that cause declines are just made worse by the drought.
Yeah, this may sound like a stupid question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. What does it mean to call a species extinct? Is there an official body that meets and hands down a ruling? Is this a consensus among biologists? What is that process like? Because clearly you're finding fish. It's not that there were no fish found, but what is that process like, and when do you begin to entertain that that word?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting question, actually, because there is no real process that I'm aware of for declaring a species extinct, because the Endangered Species Act actually has been very successful at keeping species from going extinct. And we have an additional wrinkle in the question, which is that there is a captive population of smelt that can be maintained for a fairly long period of time after they disappear from the wild. So it would presumably take a bunch of representatives of the agencies who are working with smelt to declare it extinct, but I'm not aware of any formal process that's used for that.
You mentioned the captive population that is kept alive and can be kept alive. Is there some possibility, perhaps, that if the drought conditions eventually go away and we see return to water flows and other things that people are trying to do to restore the Delta, that at some point these fish could be reintroduced to that native habitat?
Well, that certainly is the hope, and that's the reason that population is there. And especially if wetter conditions come back, there presumably would be better habitat for the smelt at that time. But you have to realize this is also a long-term proposition. The smelt would eventually have to have habitat all year round and on all years for it to survive, because it has just a one-year life cycle. So it has to survive every year. And trying to create those conditions, even in recurring drought, is what will be difficult. I think it can be done if we're willing to really figure out what the habitat requirements are and provide the fresh water they need for spawning. But that would be very hard. There's no question about it.
Most of the time when people talk about the Delta and the smelt, the two are inextricably linked. Specifically, people talking about the smelt as being a critical bellwether species for the overall health of the Delta ecosystem. Do you see this potential extinction as being something that we're going to see a chain reaction down the road in the food chain, in the ecosystem, in the Delta?
Well, you have to realize the Delta smelt itself has been had such low populations for so long, it's not been very much a functioning part of the system. But it does represent a whole bunch of other fishes that require a functioning estuary to work. And if the Delta smelt goes extinct, that tells you that the estuary, San Francisco estuary, is not working as well as it could be to support fish populations. So these include fish like the striped bass, which is a non-native species but a very important game fish, as well as Chinook salmon, which require the delta for various portions of their life cycle. And then there are two runs of Chinook salmon that are also listed species. We have the longfin smelt, also listed, green sturgeon, also listed. So there's a whole series of species that can be affected by a further deterioration of the estuary. So if the delta smelt goes extinct, or even just looking at its low numbers right now, it tells you that the system is not working very well for fish.
Now, I don't want to go off into the field of politics. I want to stick to biology, but is there anything that biologists can learn from the way that this has been managed? You have a biological opinion that is designed to try to keep this species alive. People have been doing various things to help in the situation. Certainly, it's a political football with the California's ongoing water issues, even in years where we don't have a historic drought like we have this year in the past three or four. But is there anything that people in your profession can learn from the way that biologists have dealt with this situation and how do you keep a population of fish like this alive?
Well, this is, you know, the delta smelt, since it's been listed, has become one of the most studied fish in the estuary. So, in fact, we know an awful lot about its biology. And the basic problem is that with this one-year life cycle, it's very sensitive to different factors that cause its decline. And I think that with concerted efforts, we could actually find ways to keep it going. But it still takes some additional study, or not so much. Actually, I should even say that really what it takes is a bunch of people really sitting down and figuring out what are some large scale experiments we could conduct in the estuary to see if we can keep the smelt going. And I think there are some things we can do, but nothing is easy.
There's many people in the San Joaquin Valley, many of them farmers, who they talk about the smelt rather disparagingly. And they often say something that I've found not to be true, but I want to hear from you. And they say, well, the smelt is not native to the Delta. Is that the case?
No, I don't know where that comes from. There was a fake paper put out and circulated a few years ago that would claim this, but all the work we've done definitively shows that this species is native to the system. There are records that go back to the early 1900s. We did genetic studies of the smelt to show it's very definitely a local species. It shows its own distinctive genetic signature, as well as being shown it's most closely related to a marine smelt that's off the California coast. So there's absolutely no reason to say it's not native. It's definitively been found that it is a native species.
And as I understand it, part of the situation with the smelt, part of the problem in keeping it alive, is it likes areas where freshwater and salty marine water come together. And in some cases, that's near where pumps are.
Well, what the smelt requires is a functioning estuary, which is when it moves up into freshwater to spawn during the winter months, and generally down in the Suisun Bay region when it's rearing during the summer months, which is sort of brackish water. When people talk about releasing large amounts of fresh water into the estuary and blame the delta smelt on it, really what they're doing is not understanding that most of the fresh water that's put into the delta during the summer months is to keep that salinity from intruding in order to protect farms in the delta, which need the surrounding water for irrigation, and to protect the pumps of the East Bay Municipal Utility District and the big pumps in the South Delta that send water to cities for drinking. So the issue of putting fresh water into the system for fish is really obscured by the fact the biggest need is to put fresh water in for economic reasons.
So what's the next step at this point? Are there more surveys that are scheduled for later in the summer? And is there any ray of hope out there for the situation as we see it right now?
Well, there have been some larval smelt detected, so it suggests there's been at least some reproduction that's managed to take place this year despite the low numbers. There are surveys that will go on every month of the year, basically, looking for smelt and as well as for other species. So they are not extinct yet. The numbers are obviously extremely low, and it's clearly very close to extinction. So the ray of hope is, first off, that there may still be a small population out there somewhere that's managed to reproduce, and secondly, that we do have the captive population that can hopefully be used for a reintroduction at some point.
And if the smelt were extinct, how would that change the management of the Delta ecosystem?
I don't think it would change it much at all. The reason being you have all those other endangered species out there, and most of the actions taken to protect Delta smelt protect a whole array of other species as well, or it's water that's needed for other purposes. The main place you would see, might see an effect is that you're no longer be able to shut down the pumps in the South Delta, reduce output of the pumps in the South Delta when the Delta smelt get too close to them. But that hasn't happened for the last couple of years anyway because the Delta smelt numbers have been so low. So the bottom line is that the smelt going extinct would not affect how the Delta's operated much at all.
We've been talking with UC Davis biologist Peter Moyle. He's one of the foremost experts on freshwater fish in California, talking about the rapidly plunging numbers of Delta smelt, which has led some, including Mr. Moyle, to talk about are we prepared to talk about the extinction of this species in the coming years. Peter Moyle, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it.
That's all for this week's Valley Edition. You can email us your thoughts and comments, talk@kvpr.org, or send us a tweet @Valley Edition and @KVPR. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Jeffrey Hess and Deanna Aguilera, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.